17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA out of descent. Air control mode, auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We stop to get down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
My guest on Cosmic Perspective was a test pilot in the United States Navy, where he received rank of captain. He has a PhD in aeronautics and astronomics. He's also the author of several books. And as a NASA astronaut, he was a lunar module pilot on Apollo 14 and is the sixth man to walk on the surface of the moon. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, welcome and thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's quite an honor. Thanks again for being with us. Dr. Mitchell, as I mentioned, you were a naval test pilot. When did you become interested in flying?
Well, as a matter of fact, I became interested in flying as a child. My first flight was kind of an accident. We lived on a farm at that point, and a barnstormer landed in our field out of low on gas. And my father went into town with him and took a gas can, got him a gas can full of gas for his old airplane, this World War One airplane. And he said thank you by flying, giving us a trip around the field in his plane, and that was my first flight at about 4 years old. But after that, I became interested, and when I could get away from work on the farm, I'd go out and be a line boy at a local airport, washing airplanes, parking airplanes, doing those things that line boys do. And they didn't pay me in money. They paid me in flight time. So by the time I was 16, I had a private pilot's license.
That's very interesting. All from somebody landing on your father's farm and taking you on a flight. That's quite an experience.
Yeah, that was. And it, you know, it was an old World War One airplane, which is... And he was a barnstormer. He was going around and giving people rides, which they did in those days, because not many people knew much about airplanes, and giving people rides for and getting paid for it. So that was it.
A very special experience, yes. When did you realize that you wanted to go into space?
Well, that was kind of a circumstance. I graduated from college in 1952, and the Korean War was on, and I was about to be drafted. And I said, well, I don't mind, and to the Army, I don't mind serving my country, but if I'm going to serve, I'm going to fly. And so I checked that out, and when I graduated from college, my college sweetheart and I just got married, Louise, and it just so happened that in those days, in the early 50s, neither the Air Force nor the Navy took married men into flight training. So that area was blocked for me because I was already married. But I was already a pilot. It's just that I wasn't a military pilot. So the way I got around that was that I enlisted in the Navy, became a seaman. Then they sent me to officer school in Newport, Rhode Island. I became an ensign in the Navy. Then I applied for flight training and got it. And so I was already a pilot, but I went to Navy flight training at Pensacola. in the early 50s and spent the decade of the 50s aboard aircraft carriers in the Pacific. And as I was coming home to test pilot duty, I was already a pretty good pilot, so I was coming home being assigned to test pilot duty. And that was when Sputnik went up on October the 4th, 1957. And NASA got formed by President Eisenhower, and astronauts were being selected. And I decided I would like to do that, but all the early guys were about 4 or 5 years older than me and had a couple more years of test pilot experience. So I decided I needed to catch up with them, and I worked my way, went back to MIT, and got one of the first doctorates in aerospace, and that was how that all worked out.
It is amazing how Sputnik had an influence on many people's lives.
Yes, that is true.
Only a handful of people were chosen by NASA to become astronauts. Why do you think that you were chosen by NASA for the astronaut program?
Well, number one, I was chosen because I was in the military. I was headed for Houston, and hopefully that would put me in a position to be selected as an astronaut. But in those days, in the 60s, early 60s, the military wanted their own space program, and they organized what was called a manned orbiting laboratory. It was a research program in space. And when I thought I was going to Houston, I got a call from the Pentagon on my road, said my orders had been changed. Instead of going to Houston, I was sent to Los Angeles. Become the Navy Technical Director for the Manned Orbiting Laboratory Program, which was the military space program. Well, that was what we set out to do. However, the Manned Orbiting Laboratory Program was very short-lived. It kind of rather collapsed after the first year or so. And I asked my bosses at the Pentagon then, well, since I'm already out here in California and I'm still interested in space, but I'm also want to advance in my Navy career and in flight. They sent me up to Edwards Air Force Base, which was the Air Force main test pilot school, where I was both a student and an instructor. I was teaching what I'd learned in my doctoral program at MIT and getting to fly some of the high-performance aircraft of the Air Force at Edwards Air Force Base. And from there, I was selected with 18 other guys, we were the so-called original 19 guys, to go into the Apollo program in 1966.
And you went to the moon on Apollo 14 with Alan Shepard and Stuart Roosa. I've always wondered this feeling, and of course, only a few people experienced it. You lifted off on a Saturn V rocket that at the time was the most powerful rocket made by man. What's the physical feeling that you felt when lifting off?
Acceleration. You know, we trained on accelerators. We trained on centrifuges to get that feeling of high acceleration. And so, yes, it was an exceeding strong acceleration on the Saturn V to get us into orbit with the weight that was associated with the Saturn V. If any of our listeners have been to the Kennedy Space Center and the Saturn V Museum, that's one of the Saturn V's are on display, and of course it's a huge vehicle. And the fact that we could get it into space at all was a testament to Wernher von Braun and his team who orchestrated and devised all of that. But it was a wonderful machine, and yes, it had high acceleration to get into space, but it did.
At the time of Apollo 14, the chances of you going to the moon and return safely were like 1 in 5, I believe. During your first and only space mission, did you ever feel the experience of fear at all?
No, as a matter of fact, we had trained and trained on everything that was associated with our mission. And of course, there's a little history here that's not well known. I helped build the first lunar module. My first job with NASA was to go to a Grumman Aircraft Factory in Long Island with Fred Hayes, and he and I were the astronaut representatives to do the testing on the first lunar module as it was going through the manufacturing process. And when it was shipped off to Cape Kennedy for flight test on Apollo 9, we were then free to enter the crew cycle. And I was assigned to Apollo 10 with Gordon Cooper, and Fred was assigned to Apollo 11. Now, in those days, we served as backup crew for a flight, and then three flights later, you could be prime crew. So here I was, Apollo 10. Three flights later would be Apollo 13, and Fred was on Apollo 14, would go on Apollo 14. However, it so happened that Gordon Cooper was who I served with on Apollo 10, and he chose to retire after our service on Apollo 10 and left the program. And if those of us, those who saw the Apollo 13 movie remember, Alan Shepard wanted to come back on flight. He had been grounded with a problem, a health problem, and he had that solved, and he came back on flight status. And he and I would then be in Apollo 13. Well, that was approved at Houston, but it wasn't approved in Washington. And the NASA people in Washington said, Alan, we think you ought to get a little more training before you go into flight. So they forced a switch between our crew and Jim Lovell's crew. They, Fred Hayes and Jim Lovell, took the Apollo 13. We took Apollo 14. They got the bad machine. We got the good machine. And it just so happened that on Apollo 13, Ken Mattingly, a third friend of ours, Ken and Fred Hayes and I were kind of the three musketeers of our particular class. We were the senior guys. And Ken got bumped because he had been from Apollo 13 because he had been exposed to the measles of one of the astronauts' children. And those that saw the Apollo 13 movie would remember that. So what that caused to happen was that Ken and I were on the ground as the two senior. I was a senior lunar module pilot. He was a senior command module pilot on the ground when the Apollo 13 explosion took place. And as a result, we spent the entire mission of Apollo 13 in the simulators, practicing doing what they had to do in space to get them home safely. So we spent all that time in there practicing, I in the lunar module, he in the command module simulators, practicing and getting them home. Now, just kind of an aside note, the crew, and our crew and the operation guys that were all part of Apollo 13, we did get the Presidential Medal of Freedom for saving Apollo 13, and that's kind of the long story. And then Alan Shepard and I flew Apollo 14 with Stu Roosa to the Apollo 13 site. So we flew Apollo 13. We just called it Apollo 14.
I didn't realize there was that much of a swap of astronauts from 13 to 14.
Yeah, that was, and that, of course, was because Gordon Cooper had retired from the program, and Alan Shepard wanted to come in, and Alan was our first guy in space, but he had this health problem that kept him from flying again after his first flight until this came on. And then Washington intervened and said, no, we couldn't take Apollo 13, we'd have to take 14, and force the switch. So that was a part of all of the that took place.
As you were descending onto the surface of the moon in the lunar module with Alan Shepard, if correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you had a problem with the control panel shorting out.
Well, we had a couple, yes, we had a couple. When we were in orbit, we landed right over our landing site, as a matter of fact, we had an abort light come on in the spacecraft from something that was happening in the circuitry. And the solution to that, as it turns out, we just recycled the circuit breaker with the help of the controllers in Houston. We isolated it to a circuit breaker. We switched the circuit breaker, turned the switch on and off again, and the light went off. And that was great. We could proceeded around to our beginning of descent. And as we were descending, the landing radar did not come on as it was supposed to. And again, we recycled the circuit breaker on it. It did come on. And so everything worked fine. But now this sounds like it might have been a real significant problem. But, you know, we rehearsed and practiced all of these little problems, and we were all very good at it. All the team was very good. So when little problems like that occurred, we knew what to do to change, to fix them and get going. And a lot of this happened, and as a result, we were able to very successfully land at on our first pass, even though a few things had taken place that were little malfunctions. We'd spent all of our training practicing what to do when malfunctions occurred.
I believe you also had some problems docking, redocking back to the command module to come home.
We had the problems when we first left, were going out, and docking with the docking to pull the lunar module out of the stack and put it on the nose of the command module so that we could go to the moon. That was going out, not coming back. And Stu Russo was driving the command module at that point, did a magnificent job of hooking us back up. Now, what we think was happened is that during our preparation for liftoff, a thunderstorm passed overhead and dropped and rained hard on the spacecraft. We had to wait for that to pass before we launched, but also it got the mechanism wet, rained on it, and as we went into the atmosphere and the freezing temperatures in high altitude, I think that's what caused the, we believe that that's what caused the malfunction when we had trouble docking and pulling the lunar module out of the stack.
After you landed on the moon, what was it like to be in a place where nothing moved unless you made it move?
Well, we were, you know, prepared for all that. We had trained on the surface at Cape Kennedy with all of our equipment, of course, in one Earth gravity and not one-sixth gravity of the moon. But we had trained so, and we had practiced all sorts of malfunctions. So there really wasn't anything that was new to us, except for the fact we were on a lunar surface and one-sixth gravitation instead of Earth gravitation. And we'd practiced it so much, it just seemed natural.
You and Alan Shepard collected 93 pounds of lunar rocks and soil and were the first mission to perform lunar surface experiments, I believe.
Well, we were the first mission then to start to do science on the moon. The early guys, the Apollo 11 and 12, their job was just to prove we could land and prove we could land where we, precisely where we wanted to land. Our job was to do that and then get started with doing science on the moon. So Apollo 14, which the Apollo 13 mission, but our job was to start doing science on the moon. Our first EVA, we set up a science station out in front of the spacecraft that had quite a number of experiments set up with radios that were radio data back to Earth, which operated for 14 years in which it was radioing data back to Earth. And as a matter of fact, one of the experiments, a laser reflector, was still operating. The rest of them kind of burned out after 14 years. Their batteries and everything went dead. But the experimental package that we set up on the moon during our first extravehicular activity was still worked for 14 years. Now, that first EVA, it was called, was 5 hours, and the second one was 5 hours. And the second EVA was to do a geology trek up to the top of Cone Crater, which is 2.5 kilometers away from our landing site, which is what we had practiced quite a bit, being geologists and doing a geology trek from across the lunar surface. So we'd practiced that on several spots, like on Hawaii, on the mountain of the Big Island, and we'd practiced in Cone, in Meteor Crater in Germany. We'd practiced in Iceland. In other words, we'd practiced our techniques and things in quite a number of locales on Earth, so that there was nothing really much of a surprise to us when we got on the moon. It's just a different facility.
So by the time you really got to the moon, even climbing in those very cumbersome spacesuits was not a problem for you by practicing?
No, that was, we had that down pretty well under control, pretty well pat our procedures.
You and Alan Shepard performed some of your own experiments on the moon with a golf club and a javelin.
That was fun. That was his little experiment, and he had talked it over with Deke Slayton and the guys at Houston and the management at Houston. So, and I knew about it, so it wasn't unknown. And so when he hit his golf ball, in an impromptu fashion, I grabbed the staff from the solar wind experiment, which I'd already had already taken the experiment, which was kind of a window shade like thing. Rolled it up, put it in the data bag, and I used the staff, which was just a long pole, as a javelin, and threw it after his golf ball. And I have proved my makeshift javelin went about 6 inches further than his golf ball. So the first Lunar Olympics was one golf shot and one javelin throw, and I won by about 6 inches.
I wonder if Alan Shepard was here today, whether he would dispute that or not.
he never liked that at all, that I had an impromptu action and then picked up the staff and used it as a javelin and threw it after it. It was very impromptu, and threw it after his javelin, and it went about 6 inches further than his golf shot. He did not appreciate that, and reminded me of it all along, but we were good friends, so it worked.
A special experience on the moon that you didn't think would happen.
Yeah, we hadn't planned that, really, yeah.
On your way back to the Earth from the moon, you performed some other experiments involving ESP.
I did that going out and coming back because I had been a student of, not a formal student, but an interested in the experiments conducted at Duke University by Dr. J.B. Rhine in parapsychology and in psychic stuff. And so I talked to him, and I emulated some of the experiments that he did two times going out and two times coming back, and the way he had set up ESP experiments or psychic experiments in the laboratory. And the interesting thing is I got as good a result. I sent my results off for him to check and for Dr. Carlos Osis in New York, another scientist, to check my results. And I got as good a result at 200,000 miles out as they got in the laboratory in the room next to each other. And so that taught us very early that we now quite understand that that form of communication, the psychic world, is rooted in the quantum world, which we've now started to understand quite well, but we did not understand very well in those days. And so my psychic experiment was just a furthering of the work of Dr. J.B. Rhine at Duke University, and it worked very well.
As you're returning to the Earth from the moon, you also had a very special personal experience.
Well, as a matter of fact, all of us did, but I think I was one that made a little more out of it than most of the guys. And it was, all of us saw this experience and were amazed at seeing Earth in the heavens and seeing the stars when you're outside the atmosphere. The stars are 10 times as bright as they are when you're seeing them from Earth. So it's a magnificent field to be what you're looking at. And when you're seeing Earth in its perspective as just a planet in the solar system, that's powerful. And all of us, I think together we all called it the overview effect or the big picture effect. But I perhaps made more of my experience and detailed it more proceeded to carry out those types of quantum experiments back here on Earth at Stanford Research Institute by bringing Uri Geller into the laboratory. He was the very powerful psychic from Israel that was brought over, and we did tests on him at Stanford Research Institute, SRI, out in California, on his capabilities and showing that his capabilities, the mind over matter capabilities, were very, very real. And that was the first time that in science that that had really been done to that extent. And that was the basis for my forming my Institute of Noetic Sciences in California, which had been in existence now for over 40 years. And as we now have an outreach, we're in about 60 different countries in the universities and 60 different countries around the world with the stuff that we learned and did research in and taught over the years. And so I feel very pleased and confident that it was a very successful effort.
On your return to the Earth, you also saw the Earth as a very fragile planet and became concerned about sustainability.
Yes. Well, I think many of us have done that, but it is the fact that if you study the data, the population of Earth during this technological 20th century, see, at the end of the 19th century with Max Planck and Einstein and the great physicist at that point in time, and quantum mechanics was rather formalized by the early 1920s. The 20th century was really the century in which quantum mechanics and our understanding of the psychic world became far more important. And let me use a couple of examples here. In the English language, for example, we call our intuition our sixth sense. It really should be our first sense because it's firmly rooted in the world of the quantum world, and it's more fundamental than our sensory mechanism consisting of the atmosphere that we're in and the air that we breathe and so forth. So whereas we have called it our sixth sense, it really should be our first sense. And that's, we also now are understanding that instead of what we learned, most of us learned in school, that matter and energy are the stuff of our universe, we now have to add matter, energy, and awareness is the stuff of our universe, of these three properties of all of nature that we didn't really know until it's become a part of the learning that we now have here in the 21st century.
What advice would you give the inhabitants of this planet to create and maintain a sustainable future on the Earth?
Well, it has to begin with every one of us. We all have to learn to live, let's call it green, preserving the Earth. We have to hold our population down. We've overpopulated. We have started out at the beginning of the 20th century with about 1.9 billion people. By the beginning of the 21st century, we're up to 7 billion, and we're headed for 9 billion by the middle of the century, and consuming ourselves out of house and home. So it's important to each one of us that we be a part of learning to live sustainably and to practice the things that preserve our culture, preserve our universe. Well, we're over-consuming. We're consuming all the natural resources at an alarming rate. So we have to learn how to do it differently and to make do differently. And we have to start thinking about getting off this planet because in due course that will have to happen. But the real problem of sustainability begins with each one of us. We have to start to individually live in a sustainable way, and that means stop consuming the things the way we consume them to the very limit, and trying to preserve our forest, our trees, our living systems on Earth in a proper way. Tough problem.
Yes, on a very fragile planet, yes.
On a very fragile planet, is exactly right.
I'd like to talk a little bit about UFOs. I know you're very passionate about that and extraterrestrial life. And
well, I'm not really so passionate about it, but the fact is, yes, we have been visited. It appears. Now, that's not my area of expertise, really. I know virtually all of the experts who have spent their lifetime or their professional life studying the existence of alien presence and the various t- types of aliens that have come here and how long they've been coming here. And it appears they've been coming here for a long, long time. And even going back to the biblical times where there's a record of chariots of fire in the sky. But it's not really my area of expertise, but I know some about it.
You feel that, for instance, Roswell, New Mexico, that this country and other countries are keeping information from the public on these type of things?
Well, it's a great concern to me and mystery to me why our governments have been so strong in not promulgating this information. Now, of course, several of the European countries have opened their files and do admit and do acknowledge the presence of the UFOs. Our country has not officially done so yet, and there does seem to be a cabal of individuals, perhaps moneyed individuals and corporations, that are seem to be trying to keep a secret. But I don't think it's a secret anymore. Most people know that we have been visited, and the experts that have been studying this for quite a number of time, if you read their material, you can get a pretty good handle on what the visitors are about and how they have been observing us, it seems, for quite a long time.
I have a couple more questions to ask you if you have some time.
Go right ahead.
Your feelings of the importance of the space program and the future importance of the space program?
Well, yes, I think we have to develop our space technology. We have to be prepared to leave this planet at some point. Our sun will burn out in due course. Now, we may be talking a long time in the future with that one. But nevertheless, we must be thinking about if our civilization is to survive, leaving this planet. But we don't have the technology at this point that the aliens have used to come here. And we must develop that and perfect that space transport technology to far more than we have it at the moment. And let's hope that we can do that in the near future. And it's very clear that our visitors have been coming here and watching us for a long time.
The last question I have, this is one that is a personal question. When you look up at the moon after making that incredible journey from the Earth, of course, what are your thoughts?
Oh, well, I feel very pleased that I have was selected to be one of the early explorers of the moon. And it was an exploration. And, of course, we humans are explorers. I came from a family of explorers. They went west after the Civil War in the 1870s to go to the west when Texas and New Mexico were still not even states at that point, to live out there. And I grew up in that area, including being in Roswell when that took place. And so we have to, at this point, recognize that we are the species on a planet that has a finite life ahead of it, and we have to govern ourselves accordingly and learn to protect what we have and to start to live in a sustainable way and protect it in a sustainable way, and that's going to take all of us doing it. If sustainability is to be realized, let it begin with me, each one of us.
Dr. Mitchell, thank you very much for helping to make this American dream of landing on the moon possible, sharing your life-changing experiences with us, and helping us to understand the importance of sustainability.
Well, thank you. That's what I do, and I appreciate the opportunity to say my piece in it.
Thank you again for being with us today, Dr. Mitchell. It's been quite an honor.
You have a good day, too.
Cosmic Perspective is an Andy Panero's production.